The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
The enemy of the people, and they are.
It's a serious question.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, it's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and with us today is Bon Vivant, a Playboy thousandaire, star of stage, screen, television, political activism, George, thanks for being with us.
Wow, that's the sexiest welcome I've ever heard.
Bon Vivant, you know who I once heard described that way?
Who?
Orson Bean.
Oh my God, I remember him. He used to come to a bar I used to work at in Midtown years ago.
Really? He was. I was on a show with him. to tell the truth, him and Betty White were among the people who tried to guess who we were, and
oh my
they introduced
God.
Him as a bon vivant. So I've always wanted to use that.
I feel so seen.
That's it. Well, we're going to take a quick break to pay the bills. When we come back, we'll talk about acting, political activism, and of course, how do you become a bon vivant? Stick around. It's Just Ask the Question. We'll be right back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth. With Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and I've even taken off my sunglasses with me today. George, you were in Sex and the City. That's why I called you a bon vivant. It seemed appropriate.
A butt vivant.
I didn't go there.
I did.
Yes, you did. So anyway, it's Just Ask a Question. So I've always wanted to just ask you this question. How was it being on Sex and the City?
I had an extremely positive experience on that show. Everyone from the casting director, the casting experience. I remember when I was cast, it was like my third time going out to read for something that summer. And by that time I had this sort of, I don't care kind of an attitude about it. And I think that maybe helped me because I wasn't nervous anymore at the audition. I was just sort of, okay. And
fine, another one.
But they couldn't have been cooler. I mean, obviously they liked something I was doing because they kept calling. But and then on the set, and my scene partner was Cynthia Nixon. She was great. Everybody was pretty great. That was a good experience.
Best story from the set. What do you got?
I'll give you a couple. I was in several scenes, but with two shoot days. And the first shoot day was on a set. Cynthia and I were in our respective apartments looking at each other through our windows, or she thought I was looking at her. And so we did the stuff where I had clothes on. And then my final scene in the window was me without any clothes on. I just have a towel on and I take the towel off. And it just happened to be that camera setup where Sarah Jessica chose to come in and watch. I felt like a little on the spot. It was probably just coincidental, but maybe not, you know, maybe. You know, she was nowhere to be seen. You know, I wasn't even in, you know, I don't even know. I didn't even know she was in the building. We shot it out in on Long Island City and at Silver Cup. And then just as we're about to roll on the setup where I take off my towel and show Cynthia my naked ass, that's when Sarah comes in and decides to watch on the set. And I thought,
did she like your naked ass or was she sitting in front of you?
I guess. And you want to know something really sad? This is a true story. I wanted to feel really thin that day. So I didn't eat all day. And so they did my camera setup first. And then we, you know, we cut and then we repositioned to get Cynthia. And as soon as they were done, all right, that's a wrap on George. We're going to reposition to Cynthia, beeline to the craft services table. I ate shit, Brian, that I'd never eaten before. I had ice cream.
Did you put pants on before you went?
Probably not. I was so goddamn hungry. I starved myself to look as thin as I at least feel thin.
There you go.
And then when we did the camera setup for the grocery store scene, we shot that a week later on location. And on the week in between, I had broken my foot. So in that scene, I'm walking on a broken foot.
Wow. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
method act.
Yeah, and whenever I see that, whenever it pops on television, I'm always reminded of that broken foot.
Well, let me ask you this: what got you? I've asked this of everyone I've had on the show that's been in entertainment. What drove you? What was the drive that got you there?
To go into entertainment?
Yeah, to go into acting. What? Why?
I've always liked performing. I've always been an extrovert of sorts.
I can't tell.
I think it comes. Yeah, I know. I'm a wallflower, terribly shy. And I think it comes from my dad's side of the family for sure. My dad was always, my dad was definitely an extrovert. I think a miscalling. He died 30 years ago, but I think his second.
How'd he die?
He had heart issues. He died. He had a second bypass surgery.
How old was he?
53. Young. Wow.
Yeah, my dad died young of lung cancer at 55.
Young.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Yeah. Well, on that cheery note. So your dad was your driving force into acting?
In a way, yeah. He was. He always encouraged it. He, in another life, would have been a great MC. Like, he would have been a really good host for, like, the Oscars or something. Like, he was,
really?
Oh, God, yeah. He would have been really good at that. I would say the closest famous person whose humor was probably like Billy Crystal. My dad was very really? Billy Crystal like. Yeah, I think so.
Borscht Belt humor.
My dad was the borschiest non-Jew Borscht Belt humorist completely. He loved Woody Allen. He loved Joan Rivers. I got to work for Joan Rivers, which he would have gotten a kick out of.
What'd you do for Joan?
I managed her social media for the last few months of her life.
Wow.
Yeah, I was just hired.
You know, and Kathy Griffin names her as a leading influence for her comedy.
100%. She and Kathy were very tight.
Yeah.
So the Han side, they were the performers for sure. And so my Uncle Bill, my dad's brother, also had the performance bug, and his daughter Catherine Hahn is my cousin, is of course an actress as well. So it kind of it's a Hahn family trait.
Can you so is being solo? Yeah. But anyway, sorry, couldn't resist.
You made the
Kessel Run in 12 parsecs. That's a Hahn. That's a Hahn family trait. We've been doing it for eons.
Great kid. Don't get cocky.
Yeah, that's. That was a good one. So, do you remember a moment on stage, a moment when you just said, this is it? This is what
vividly.
What was it?
I never had the courage to do theater in high school. I was too embarrassed. I thought it was just something like a guy didn't do if he didn't want to get made fun of. But going away to college, I grew up in Cleveland and I went to college in Boston, and that was, you know, it was a new environment. People didn't know me. And so you can reinvent yourself. Right.
Right.
And so that's when I started auditioning for theater, and I got cast in a production of George Bernard Shaw's Arms and the Man.
Wow.
And I played the father, like a, I played like a 65-year-old man, and I had to wear like a gut. I grew a beard and we grayed it out, and I had gray hair, and I had this one line in the second act, that maybe it was the way I delivered it, but it brought the house down. And it was the first time I got a huge laugh, and it was in Brian. It was intoxicating.
Yes, it is.
And I knew right then and there that that's really what I wanted to be doing. I loved it. I loved it ever since.
That's, yeah. Oh, that's, I, there was a time I did a production of My Three Angels, and mm-hmm. I had the lead, the Joseph part played by in the movies by Humphrey Bogart. And there's a scene where I walk in with a Christmas tree, and there's a tiny one on the kitchen table, and I've got like a 6-foot tree. And I go, oh, I see you already have a tree. And one night as I'm delivering that line, it was of course an artificial tree, and you know how they're put together, it's like a broomstick.
Yeah.
You know, the, you know, the branches, and then the very top is where you put the little plug of, as I'm sitting there holding that tree, the whole bottom falls out, and I've got just, you know, this little top of the tree, and I go, I see you already have a tree, and it's obviously in much better shape than mine.
And good.
And it, and I go, oh, this is fucking great.
Isn't live theater is terrifying and exhilarating, because yeah. so much can go wrong.
And always it, does.
Yeah. It's terrifying and exhilarating all at once. There's nothing like it. It's impossible to describe.
What was your first big part that you liked? Or not big part, but bit part, but something where you knew at that point in time you were a professional.
I was still in college, and it was like the nice thing about college theater is that in high school too, I suppose, is you get an opportunity that you rarely, if ever, get in professional settings where you play people who are not your age. And so right. You have to sort of extend or stretch or whatever. So I got to play that. I did that one part I was just talking about, where I got that first big intoxicating laugh. And then the next play I did was quite serious. We did the Normal Heart, Larry Kramer's play. And this is in 1991 at Boston College, which was a conservative Catholic Jesuit university. And the play was directed.
The Jesuits think they're liberal, but that's another story. Go ahead.
Yes. Comparatively, they are.
They are, yeah.
It was directed by a Jesuit. We didn't cut a fuck or a cocksucker. We didn't cut a kiss scene. He kept the whole script intact. And we had people walking out.
It's the Catholic Church. They keep the cock sucking in. Oh,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, baby. And
I couldn't resist. Sorry.
You had to go. You had to do it. It's easy. So I was cast in the lead in that. And that was when I also realized that theater is not just for entertainment purposes. I felt like I was part of something bigger than myself, that was something more important. That doing that play led to my coming out. Doing the Normal Heart was pivotal for me.
How was that? How was that? I mean, when you came out, how long ago was that?
Oh, 31 years ago. 31 years ago, yeah.
How does that compare with the atmosphere in the U.S. today?
Oh, I think it's much easier today. And it's also was probably much easier for me than it was for the generation before me.
Yeah.
You know, the generation before me was dying.
Stonewall.
Largely. And Stonewall.
Yeah.
But I was just before AIDS. Like AIDS started to really get headlines in the mid 80s. I was still in junior high. And by the time I came out, this was 91. And it had wiped out a lot of people. But there was traction was being made by groups like ACT UP.
Do you think AIDS in some perverse way helped people to understand better or that it made
I think it forced them to, because it was that thing. Yes. It was like COVID, and you often hear the comparison. At some point, you're going to know somebody. At some point, it's going to affect you directly. It's going to be a brother, an uncle, a parent, somebody. You're going to know someone. And that then my number came up and I knew someone.
Yeah, we all ended up knowing someone. It was universal. It does. Yeah, and that's one of the things that COVID and those things teach, is that the universality of the human species, we have far more in common than we have different from each other, but we always choose to talk about the differences.
But I think it's much different now. I know it's much different now. When we were growing up, when I was growing up, we didn't have, you know, my role models on pop culture television were like Paul Lynde and Charles Nelson Reilly. Like, that was it. We didn't, there was no.
You didn't have a big choice there.
Right?
Well, I like Paul Lynde better than Charles Nelson Reilly myself, but I like them both. But
they were a blast. But like the code was like, you know, and now we're living, it carries over to like conservatives today who were like, you know, would have thought at the time, oh, if Paul Lynde could only just find the right girl, you know, like that's the mentality.
Well, and do you remember the movie Vanishing Point, like 1971, I think it was. And there's the portrayal of gay people in that movie was sinister. You know, it was. And it was like, you know, they're evil gay people out to hurt us. And the change from there to anything after that was to me, it was night and day. And I don't know when, I always say the 70s were a little more inclusive than we are today. We're far more distant from each other, or separated into our little tribes. But in the 70s, we all wore the same ugly fat ties. Everybody, even white people, wanted to have an afro. Mm-hmm. And we all wore those goddamn horrible yellow, banana yellow pants and the paisley shirts.
Right.
With our wedgie platform shoes.
But I wonder, like, so many things that I wonder if, Studio 54 couldn't happen today. It was before my time. And as I understand it, and as I've seen in footage and documentaries, and
I snuck in twice.
It had a mix. Like, you had your drag queens, you had you had your like really bold queens, and then you had more closeted types, and you had straight people in suits, people in hot pants. It was a mix. And I can't imagine that happening today. Like, everyone in their own little tribe.
And that was just when Sylvester Stallone walked in.
Right. And Michael Jackson and Betty Ford and Liza Minnelli and Halston. And it's like, where am I? It's, you know.
Right. Well,
you know. So, yeah, I don't think that could happen today, because everybody's so, as you said, you know, tribal.
Here's my big question for you. Do you find humor more difficult these days than in years past?
Probably. Like, you know, I think humor has changed. I think comedians, I'm not a comedian in the stand-up sense, but I forget who said it. It might have been Chelsea Handler. One has to grow. And you have to change with the times. Like Joan Rivers, by the time she died in 2014, she wasn't saying the same kind of jokes that she was telling in the 70s. You know, you couldn't say the word abortion. You had to say, she would say things like appendectomy in quotes. Also,
funny, we can't say that today either, can we?
Right. Things do change, but I think in comedy, I think it's a comedian's job to push the boundary move the line always. I love.
And bring a laugh.
I love being challenged by them. I watched recently, I think the most recent stand-up special I watched was Bill Burr's latest on Netflix. And I'm watching this. I had a great time watching it. And I'm thinking to myself, as I'm watching it, this guy's going to really piss people off.
But isn't that what Carlin did? Isn't that what everyone did. I mean, remember, certain people went to jail because they said, you know, they talked about things.
100%.
And, you know,
100%.
Yeah. And Richard Pryor, and
Lenny Bruce. Them,
Lenny Bruce, the one who went to jail, of course.
Lenny Bruce did his most of his shows from jail, I'm guessing.
Well, I'm not touching that line, Pilgrim.
That guy was like, you know, as I understand it, just got thrown into jail like every 10 minutes.
But. Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, he asked for every 5, and then when he passed out, put him in every 10. But that's
right. But again, a boundary pusher, and we needed that. Like, it was like, up until then, it was that very polite country club Borscht Belt humor, you know, your Bob Hopes, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's all very safe. It's all very safe. But then we had this sort of like, it was around the same time that movies, like filmmakers, started to break from the studio system. A lot shook up in the 60s. You know, we had the French New Wave influenced our filmmaking here, and we had these great movies. And the same was true with comedy. There was a huge shift.
And music.
And music. Yeah. It got bolder. And there was an awakening. Let's put it that way. I think there was awakening. There was
awakening.
We're due for another one, I would think.
I would. Okay. So what boundary do you think more than any other needs to be pushed that perhaps isn't?
What boundary that needs to be pushed? I don't know about a specific boundary, really, but I do think we need a sense of humor about ourselves, because everybody's a thing. You know, there are Black people, there are Jewish people, there are gay people, there are trans people, there are lesbians, and suddenly no one's got a sense of humor about themselves.
You've been to one of my family reunions, I take it.
I was just getting to that. But nobody, it seems like nobody's got a sense of humor about
it. I agree. Well,
and everyone takes themselves way too fucking seriously.
Well, that I definitely agree. Have you ever been in the White House press briefing room?
I've seen footage.
Yeah, that's some of the people in that place. Whoa.
Sebastian's tightly wound.
Yeah, I bet you could unwind him real fast. Work with me on this one. Come on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Poor Gorka. Good God.
Oh, I remember him. but yeah, a lot of the reporters, we take ourselves way too seriously.
You're in a different business.
Yeah. Well, not anymore.
No, I know. I know. But I mean, it's you're in the news business, which is not. And then there was this merging. I don't know if it's worth touching upon, but like.
Yeah.
The likes of Jon Stewart and Bill Maher have kind of blurred the lines.
Yes. Well, how about not necessarily the news? I mean,
not necessarily the news. Exactly.
But who was it?
Was it Chris Wallace who interviewed Jon Stewart years ago and kind of, you know,
or Mike, was it?
Or not Chris Wallace. I'm sorry. Mike Wallace. You're right.
Yeah.
And in making the comparison, and I thought it wasn't really fair. And because I'm watching this going, Jon Stewart is not a journalist. He's not a reporter. He's a satirist.
Yes.
It's a different business.
It's Will Rogers type of business. While you use facts to skewer people, you're not presenting the facts, and nor should you be considered a news source.
Exactly.
And that's kind of changed. We believe that, you know, Bill Maher is giving us news, and he's not. He's a comedian that has been in a lot of bad comedy movies.
I'm glad he's not doing movies anymore. They weren't his strong suit.
Oh, no, they weren't. What was he? The Pizza Boy or whatever was that one?
Everything Forgettable.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of it. I can only remember it was bad.
Nor can I.
Yeah. But no, he's Jon Stewart was a comedian. And Jon Stewart was more successful comedian, I think, in many ways smarter. But the satire that he puts out there was... straight. I mean, all of these people, even the Colbert and others, it's all Will Rogers end of the spectrum.
Yes.
Walter Cronkite.
Exactly. They're in different businesses, and to compare the two, it's apples and oranges.
So before we go to the break, I guess, get me to you've been an actor. You grew up. Mm-hmm. When did you become politically active, and what sparked that for you?
I started to pay more attention to politics, Brian, I think probably in the 2000 election. And I would, because of that weird electoral college fuckery.
Anything called hanging chavs.
Thank you.
I thought I was in a bar in South Texas. What's hanging?
And so there was that disaster, which got my attention. I mean, I remember paying attention to Clinton when I was in college, and Bush, like Bush won and Clinton when I was in college. But then I got really fired up, I suppose, when Trump was the nominee. And I just thought, holy shit, this is going to fucking happen. And then I didn't become known for it or didn't get, I still don't think I'm serious about it. On Twitter, it was Molly Jong Fast who tweeted a video of mine having a satirical nervous breakdown walking down Columbus Avenue. And then it went viral, and I thought, well, this could be my Citizen Kane, or I could make some lemonade here. So
yeah, or both.
Right.
So, for me, it goes all the way back to Ronald Reagan, the first election I ever voted in.
Yeah,
and I thought he was a screaming fascist Nazi back then, and I believe it to this day. I think he's the founder of the feast that gave us Donald Trump. Without Ronald Reagan capitalizing off a Nixon Southern strategy from the 70s when I was in, you know, middle school and high school, if that hadn't occurred, we wouldn't have been saddled with, you know, Donald Trump. Of course, if they hadn't killed Bobby Kennedy, things would be a lot different too. But right. The simple fact of the matter is everything that we see today in the GOP began with my main man, Ronald Reagan, who I disparaged in college and wrote essay after essay and news article about what a piece of crap he was.
Did you grow up in a political family? Did you guys talk politics at the dinner table?
Couldn't help it. The Karam family in Louisville was my uncle was my grandfather was a circuit court judge. My two uncles were one was a state senator, and at a time when they allowed Democrats in Kentucky, he was the leader. He was the Senate Majority Leader. And my other uncle, Pete, is a judge as well. And my dad was a car salesman. So politics and bullshit, we got plenty of it at the dinner table. In fact, I was covering a trial in Kentucky once. Frances Jones Mills, who was the treasurer of the state of Kentucky, was up. She was being prosecuted for stealing money from the state. And I had a reporter come over to me and said, "Brian, are you related to Dave or Pete or you know, my grandfather, Fred?" And I told him, you know, the story I told you, grandfather, judge, grandmother, and my grandmother was one of the first females to plead a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. She raised five kids, including one severely autistic daughter, still went to night school, got her law degree and took a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. So I tell her that, and she goes, "So let me get this straight. Your grandfather was an attorney and a judge, and your uncles are attorneys and politicians, and your dad sells cars for a living, and you're a reporter." And I said, "Yeah." And she goes, "Couldn't any of the men in your family find an honest way to make a living?" So yeah,
see, I wish we were not. I was not. I was just talking about this with my mother the other night. We were not a politically engaged family. I think my dad was a Reagan Republican. I'm pretty sure. I can't see him voting for Carter.
My grandparents marched with Martin Luther King, and my uncle became a Republican who worked with Mitch McConnell.
Oh God.
Yeah, and then left the reason why he left the Republican Party was Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
The first politician I interviewed outside of my family was Mitch McConnell. And the night before I went in to see him, my uncle said, "Listen, you're going to go interview Mitch tomorrow, right?" And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "You got to remember one thing about Mitch." I said, "What?" And he goes, "Mitch McConnell is about one thing and one thing only." And I said, "Yeah, what is it?" And he goes, "Mitch McConnell."
Yeah.
And that hasn't changed in 40 years.
Yeah. Has he always been the Prince of fucking Darkness?
Yes. Yes. And wow. But his first wife was head of when he was the the county judge executive, you know, like the mayor of the county mm-hmm. in Jefferson County, Kentucky, and a million people, large area. And he his first wife had a equal rights commission that she headed up while he was the county executive. And I mean, completely different vibe from him then and now. As far as progressive, he was considered a moderate until he went to the Senate. And then he won that Senate race based on one ad. He was behind Dee Huddleston, was considered like Kentucky's Kennedy, had the Senate spot that he ran for. And when he ran for it, he was behind by 20 points till he ran one ad, and it was a bunch of dogs running through the countryside barking. And then the, you know, where is Dee Huddleston? Where is Dee? We can't find Dee. Where's our senator? And then these coonhounds ran up the steps of the Capitol, and supposedly could never find Dee because Dee was never there. Big bunch of bullshit, because Dee was there 94% of the time. He was in person 94% of the time for votes, and it didn't matter because that cartoon frickin', you know what I mean, I say cartoon, but it was a live action commercial won the Senate race for Mitch McConnell. And he was the only pickup by Reagan in his reelection year. He flipped, you know, there were no long coattails for Ronald Reagan. It was Mitch McConnell, which once again tells me that Ronald Reagan's responsible for every piece of shit that we currently have to deal with in the U.S.
How do you really feel, though?
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about unblocking portals.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. Seriously. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your choking host, Brian Karam. I don't know what it is. It, maybe too much bourbon, George. I haven't figured it out yet. I still have a little left. Anyway, with us is George
Mon. Do you want a straw?
Yeah, that's the best way to do it, actually.
Really, just get a long.
Been doing it, you know, you know, ever since he walked down the, I tell you what it was for me. It was when he made fun of the handicapped reporter. That's when I began my drinking, and I haven't stopped since.
I can't, attaboy, look at you, all growed up. Can't believe it got past that. I can't believe it got past the Access Hollywood tape. I can't believe, how did we get here, Brian? Like, I'm
looking. That's a good question,
like,
man.
Like, we talk about it on our panels with Mary Trump, and we kind of like often do remixes of that same question: how did we get here, and how do we get out of this?
Education, awareness,
right, and
voting.
Was there ever anybody in your memory of even being interested in politics that was like the Marjorie Taylor Greene or the Lauren Boebert of the landscape? Was there ever shit like this?
There was one guy I remember who was a state, when I covered the state house in Kentucky, and I can't remember his name. He was an old guy who came out one day to preach because he didn't want, there was a equal rights amendment or legislation in Kentucky about what I don't remember, but he come out and he says, when my bones are as cold as the waters that cover the great Titanic, then we will see that I was right and God is in his glory and we shall all white people come together. And that,
colorful. Wow.
We laughed at the guy.
Mm-hmm.
He got voted out. And I thought that's the worst we'll see. But, you know, I go back to, it's our fault. One of the things that I have recognized since Ronald Reagan allowed, you know, media properties to buy each other up, there's fewer and fewer reporters, which means fewer and fewer eyes on morons like Marjorie Taylor Greene. There's huge news deserts where there aren't even local papers anymore. And for example, the paper that covered Kentucky was the Courier Journal and Louisville Times. And it was family owned by the Bingham family. And it was consistently voted one of the top 10 newspapers in the United States for 50 years. And then the Bingham sold it off when the elder Bingham died, and it sold off to Gannett. And now it's been turned into a shopper. And it's no coincidence that people like Mitch McConnell came to power after the end of the that type of newspaper. We don't have those eyes. I mean, just to get a set to get, and there would be people in the state of Kentucky that would make fun of the Courier all the time, but everyone who ran for office wanted to be endorsed by the Courier because that gave them legitimacy. And they had this huge way they would go through. I mean, you had to interview before, and this is everybody that ran for office that wanted their endorsement, had to show up, go to an interview process through five or six people, while there were a staff of people that would do a deep dive on who the, you know, and do opposition research on the person running for office. It made for a lot more transparency than we have today. I mean, right. Hell, I can't even count on the New York Times to get the facts straight anymore.
It's interesting, like, the, gosh, you're talking about the 80s. In the 80s, we had Ronald Reagan, and we had deregulation, and we had Gordon Gekko, Greed is Good, and we had Jack Welch at GE. We had this, what a strange...
And Crockett and Tubbs.
And Crockett and Tubbs. But, yeah, God, we sure did.
And the Love Boat.
Well, that was the 70s.
And into the, yeah,
and right. Into the 80s. Yeah. I used to have the craziest crush on Captain Steubing. Don't ask me why. That's going to take a lot of therapy.
But see, I first remember him as Murray and Mary Tyler Moore.
Yes. Murray.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I loved him.
Yeah.
I loved Gavin McLeod and Ted Knight. I could have watched them all day.
It was a great show. I could watch it.
Yeah.
What show do you, now I'm switching gears. What show would you like to see back that you haven't seen in a while?
Oh God, it's funny we're talking about Mary Tyler Moore because I just watched the pilot again, like maybe last more than 6 months ago, probably. And I was surprised at how relevant it still is. And how fresh it still seems. This young woman, she's not married. She wants to work. You know, it was and the odds against her, or the strikes against her.
And how she just weather guy was, and that was an integrated cast too.
Yes. And so, what would I like to see again? Oh God, you talk about the Love Boat. I would love to see that. I would love to see Fantasy. I'd love to see Fantasy Island. I would like. Here's what. The plane, boss, and Ricardo Montalban, like God, good, like Chrysler Cordoba.
Who knew?
And what else did I love? I used to love Dynasty.
Wow.
Sure. Talk about the 80s. My God. And when I was a little kid, before I fully understood it, now I understood it. I understand it more and better. Was All in the Family, MASH.
Yes.
Yeah.
Here's my favorite, WKRP in Cincinnati.
Oh, beautiful. Great sitcom. Solid. Yeah. And I don't know. Can we do the sitcoms anymore? Is there an audience for it?
I don't know. You can't do a lot of comedy that I've seen on TV. You couldn't make Blazing Saddles today.
I was just talking about that the other day. Yeah. That movie could not be made today.
I know you couldn't do it.
But here's the thing. We were talking about how
the common clay of the West, you know, morons.
What we can't say anymore.
Yes.
And you can't, on the surface, that movie seems racist, but the conceit is that the black guy is the smartest one in the room.
Yes. Excuse me while I whip this out.
Good morning, ma'am. Isn't it a lovely day?
Up yours. What would you like to do? I don't know. Play chess? Screw. Let's play chess.
Is it true what they say about how you people are gifted?
It's true.
Oh, you can't. Yeah.
Where are all the white women at? You can't.
Just beautiful. Like, yeah. It's just a beautiful movie. And again, you're right. Couldn't make that today.
And there was I don't know if you remember, there was a thing on that you really couldn't do today. It was called the word association test. And between Chevy Chase and Richard Pryor, a skit on Saturday Night Live, first season of Saturday Night Live. You could not do that today. It starts out with he's interviewing Richard Pryor for a job as a janitor. And he goes, I'm going to give you just a simple word association test. You know, like if I say green, you say tree. He goes, okay, all right, got it. So green tree. And then it becomes racist very quick. To the where tar baby, peckerwood, you know, and then it goes, and then.
Oh, right, I remember this.
Yes. He goes, and then he says the N word. He goes, dead honky. And
that's, yes.
Funny as, and, but it seems racist, but the joke was on the guy who was racist.
Right.
And you can't, I think nuance and subtlety is lost. It's all got to be blunt and over the head.
Are we getting dumber?
I don't know, but slapstick going to be coming back pretty soon. We'll be grunting at each other to be understood. Yes. I think part of that is, again, what I do for a living. When I first got into this business, we were told, you know, write for an 11th grade reading level. Mm-hmm. And then it became a 7th grade reading level, then a 5th grade. And my argument against that has always been, in fact, one day during a stand-up in my 20s, I said, you know, there was a union walkout and I said both sides had reached amicable accords. And I got back to the office and I was told I can't use those words. And I go, well, which ones didn't you want me to use? Union, accords, resolve, amicable. Can't use that. Nobody knows what it means.
Oh, I said, my God.
God forbid someone should pick up a freaking dictionary and look up what it means.
Brian, look at how people are communicating.
Yes.
Snapchat, instead of writing words and the way people text, you know, probably is spelled P-R-O-L-L-Y.
Yeah, and I can't keep up with that.
No one's writing anymore. So we're communicating with the digital equivalent of cave paintings again.
Yeah, I think you're right. And pictures.
We're back to that. And yeah, memes. That's what I mean. That's
memes exactly are cave what I mean. Paintings. That's all they yes. are. That's
exactly. Digital cave painting. Cave painting of a digital era. You know, I am a sucker for a well-crafted word. Come on.
Always have been. I like good wordplay. Oh, it's foreplay, you know? I'm telling you, tough room. Hey.
Oh, Rodney. Beautiful.
My favorite. I did that one that's how I got Donald Trump to start Chopper Talk was doing Rodney.
All right. So riddle me this. So it infuriates me on a daily basis that bitch is like still in the zeitgeist in the way that he is. He's off Twitter and he's in his own tanking social media network. He's not president anymore, and yet he is in the news every goddamn day. When does it stop? When he's dead?
Hopefully before I run out of wild turkey.
Before you run out of wild turkey.
Well, now he's, I mean, look, he doesn't care.
He can't be out of the news cycle for longer than, you know, that's it's oxygen for him.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I really think the best place for him would be Otisville, a 8x10 cell where he has no access to the outside world and he sweats and can't have hamburgers. Mm-hmm. But he will be part of the it's not Trump anymore. It's Trumpism.
Trumpism, right.
DeSantis, it's Marjorie Taylor Greene. But these lesser imps and minions of Satan don't have the abilities that Trump is very conniving. Mm-hmm. They do not have the abilities to be out there in the public eye like he does. And after a while, they grow very tiresome. So I don't see anyone I don't see Trumpism being long-term. I see the effects of Trumpism being long-term.
That's an interesting observation because like of all of them, I spit out this theory the other day, with these nominees or these candidates whom he backs and people, you know, his crowd sees it or the hungry ones see it as kingmaking. And I'm thinking, no, it's a sign that you're not a star.
Yes. Exactly. Because
he's the only star. And if he's going to put his name next to you, whether you're Mike Pence or J.D. Vance, he doesn't think that much of you because you're never going to be the star that he is.
And he has exactly. He feels comfortable with you being a second banana in his Broadway production.
It's his version. It's Latin. It's Trump Latin for you're no competition.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I endorsed you. That means you suck.
Right.
That's.
I'm still shinier.
Without me.
I'm still shinier. Right. Yeah.
As far as the turds go, I'm the shiniest.
And you bring up something, though, that's actually very encouraging because he is and this is not a compliment or in any way toward him, but he is, of all of it, and it being Trump and Trumpism, he is the most charming. And again, that's not a compliment. And
Playboy. That's, yeah, I never found him charming, but I get your point. Yes.
But DeSantis is less charming.
Oh, DeSantis has all the warmth of, you know, like a cold steel wool pad applied to your ass.
Awful.
Yeah, that's
awful. And on a national scale, it can't really play too well.
He can't play too. I mean, he'd have to really change who he is to, and not to say that that hasn't been done in American politics, but I don't think DeSantis has it within him to do so. His modus operandi, and the part of him that frightens me the most, is his seeming ability to make sure that opposition press is not available, that he keeps everyone out from the press that he doesn't like. And that's frightening.
But I wonder if that's going to limit his traction. Like, it's, he's only going to get so far on that.
I think, well, I don't think that he can, I don't believe that he will be elected president. I do believe he will be a menace for a while. And Florida is going to be in horrible shape because of him. And, you know, at the end of the day, George, I get my biggest concern is that we will only be the United States in name only. There's about six different, you know, places where this grand experiment of democracy can break down. And I fear that that's where we're headed, where, you know, be certain pockets of the country where it'll be safe to be, you know, anything but a white male, white heterosexual male, or presenting as a white heterosexual male. I guarantee you that most of the closeted people, well, I don't even want to go down that path, but I'll just say
I've met a few.
Yeah. That it's like, really? Come on. Give me a break. But there will be only certain areas of the country it'll be okay to be something other than a person that presents as a God-fearing Christian, you know, heterosexual. And that's, and, you know, I feel for that part of the country that feels comfortable with a past that never existed, because I feel that they are supporting people that will take advantage of them the most.
But this is what gives me, I guess, a little optimism, or makes me feel better, I should say. On the left, fuck it, I'll just go for it. Like, we will always be funnier. We will always be more interesting. We will always be more curious. We will always be more clever. We'll always be better dancers, better joke tellers. You look at all of them. None of them can tell a joke to save their ass. They have no sense of humor about themselves. If they do have a sense of humor, it's at someone else's expense.
That's the sense of humor that Donald Trump has.
It's at someone else's expense.
He can be funny if he's making fun of someone else.
No sense of humor about himself. Never did.
No.
That's all. That news has been out for a long time.
Yeah.
I remember, I forget who it was, when he was being roasted, when he was doing the Comedy Central roast and he was being roasted. Apparently, because apparently when you do a roast, you kind of have to agree that, like, everything is fair game.
Right.
The only thing that he drew the line at was the question of him not being as rich as he said he was. Everything else was fair game. His hair, his, you know, whatever. But the only thing he was super sensitive about was the wealth thing.
Yeah, well, and his mushroom appendage. But hey!
Oh, so gross. So gross.
So gross.
You know, it's like an acorn and a fur patch. Yes!
Hey, now. And on that note, we're going to take one more short break. And
because we need one.
Well, I've got the bourbon. We'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast. Again, that's at JATQ Podcast.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I'm with George hun, and I had no idea he collected acorns. I collect wild turkey. Good. You're right about the sense of humor part, though. I have walked into an RNC convention, cracked a joke, they looked at me like I was a turd sitting in a punch bowl. Yeah. And I remember going to the Al Gore convention in Chicago, making fun of everybody doing the Macarena, and nobody got upset. No one. They laughed.
Case in point, I thought Michelle Wolf killed.
Oh, there was a couple of mistakes I think that she made in delivery. Mm-hmm. But I would say that as someone who's done stand-up comedy, I would just go, I would have tweaked that, you know.
Right.
But she made you laugh. That's what she's there to do.
Yeah.
I can't stand people that ascribe, you know, politics to every comedian I've ever known, good, bad, or otherwise. They just want to get a laugh.
That's their heroine, you know. Like, that's why we're doing this.
Yeah.
And also, why it's not on her? It's whoever. Why would you hire Michelle Wolf?
Exactly.
Okay, we want you to do it, but don't be you.
Yeah.
You know, you don't hire Seth Meyers or Wanda Sykes and say, but just don't be you. Be someone else. It doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't. It never has. But there are a lot of people that, because they have no sense of humor, can't understand a sense of humor.
No.
And I remember being in the White House during the Trump administration going, I know what funny is. I know what funny is. I go, well, that's pretty funny. No, I'm serious. I'm going, yeah, that's what I find funny. They couldn't even understand that their behavior was made me laugh.
Oh, Brian, the fact that is he the first president to not go to the correspondence dinner?
Oh, yeah. He would not go.
Red flag number one. Well, red flag number 150,000.
That day. Right. Every day I went for 4 years, I went through that administration going, it can't get any worse than it was the day before. And every day I was wrong. It got so bad. I remember one time me and John Bennett from CQ Roll Call, we walked in and Trump was talking about using the army on the border to, you know, ease problems with, you know, the so-called crisis that hasn't existed for 40 years. So we go in.
Brian, they're brown.
They're brown. They're okay as long as Dole Pineapple's hiring them, and then we got to get them out of the country. We want cheap tomatoes, cheap lettuce, and then out.
I do need someone to cut my lawn.
That's right. And who's going to do the azaleas? I need the azaleas done. Jesus Christ.
American.
Yes. Yeah, you got it. So we go in and I say, look, you've got to have a waiver. You can't use the U.S. Army on the border inside. That's, you know, the Posse Comitatus Act. And so we asked one of his Burberry-laden social press types. I won't say his name. Anyway, so we went in and talked to him and said, hey, you know, can you? And so we're going on talking about other issues. And he goes, Posse Comitatus Act, what is that? And I go, well, he goes, is that like a rule? And I go, no, it's a law favored by Republicans, which keeps the army from being used against citizens. That's the Posse Comitatus Act from like 1889 or 1890. And you have to get a waiver from Congress in order, and they have in the past. So we go on and we're talking. 15 minutes later, after we get done, he goes, oh yeah, and I'll circle back to you on that Hakuna Matata thing.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh,
that was from a deputy press secretary.
Oh my God. Okay, Clorox.
You can't write comedy. If I wrote what I saw in that White House up as a script, people would not buy it.
It really makes Veep look like a somber documentary.
Well, Veep actually, yes. A somber documentary.
Yes. Yeah.
Complete with sadness. That's it.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this as we round out our hour and head out into the sunset. What would you like to, what's your prediction for midterms? Where would you like to see the country go? And
oh,
what project
easy.
Would you like to do that you haven't done acting wise?
Let's see. I would love to be on the second season of And Just Like That. And I'd love to be on that show. My prediction, though, for the midterms, I think, Brian, and I'm crossing my fingers as I say this, I think that starting with the abortion fuckery that lit a fire under Democrats' ass, and people just kind of went like, oh, wait, this shit isn't guaranteed. We are going to have to show up for something and vote if we want certain, we're going to have to fight for some things. So starting with that, the abortion thing seems to have lit a fire. We're witnessing an erosion of rights for people like me. As a gay man, I wouldn't be comfortable in Florida. That's a big fuck you state to me.
Hey, me as a Lebanese American man.
I have no desire to go to Texas. So
I've been there. Get out.
So I would like to think that enough, the fuckery this year alone, although it could be cumulative, it should be cumulative, but the fuckery from this year alone, from the Supreme Court and the GOP as it has become, should ignite a fire from the left that has not been predicted, and hopefully show up at the polls in November for these midterms in numbers that no one saw coming. Like, I would really love to see that.
I me too. And I think that we in corporate media, I don't say mainstream because I don't know what that means, but I don't know what corporate media means. And corporate media has loathed to cover this correctly. And I think that that's going to come back to haunt us in 2022 during midterms. I think there's a lot of, from what I've seen in just traveling across the country in the last month, there's a lot of movement away from Trump and away from Trumpism. People bored and tired and ready to relegate him to the dustbin of history just because he won't shut the fuck up. And people,
he's such a tired show. It's like,
yeah the one hit wonders.
I love Don Rickles' act, but it seemed fresh next to Trump's. You know what I mean? Like, I could watch Don Rickles 10 nights in a row, and I know it's the same show, and I wouldn't care because Don Rickles was a genius. But Donald Trump's act is so old.
Yes.
There's no new material. It's tired. It's exhausting. And I want to say to these people, by all means, give him all of your money. Please give him all of your money.
Yeah.
Cut him the big check. Cut him the big check, please. Part of me hopes he is the nominee.
Yeah, that would be, it depends on who the Democratic nominee is, but yeah, that would be a Biden, that would be Biden too. And
yeah,
that's what that would
but,
be.
But so my prediction and my hope is that Democrats are going to show up in numbers larger than people counted on.
I think that's your mouth to God's ears, brother.
You know, get enough people angry, take away enough things and piss them off even more. We'll see what happens. Am I an expert? Hardly.
As for your Texas comment, I hope this doesn't offend anyone, but you would not be popular in Texas because you are out. But if you were closeted, you would.
Oh, Brian, let's just say that I've... How do I want to put this and not piss people off? Let's just say if you fire up a quote-unquote dating app, the number of photo-less profiles with text that alludes to discretion or on the DL or by married white male, it's not just the clergy.
Or if it is, boy, they're never in their pulpit.
Let me just put it this way. And it's not just the out people. Guys who think dicks are delicious are everywhere.
Well, you've said a mouthful there.
Literally.
I think people are more worried about, I don't understand people worried about what other people are doing in their bedroom. I can't.
What happened to the Republican belief in personal freedom? Sorry. When did that leave the menu?
They wanted to find out what freaky shit was going on in the bedroom so they could adopt it for themselves. That's when that left.
And I'll tell you something without getting too specific. In my younger years, when I was, let's just say, more sexually voracious, it was the conservative types who made me the most nervous.
I bet.
There was a lot of pent up shit in that psyche that, you know, that was exercised in a sexual direction. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. And I know where you're going with that. And mm-hmm. having, and it's, but again, I always find that it kills me that they talk, it's the hypocrisy of that type of person that bugs me. Mm-hmm. And I can feel empathy for what they're going through, but no sympathy for how they do it. They treat others because I can understand
it's self-hatred.
Yes, it is. It's self-loathing, and you reach out and take it out on everyone else. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, when I have to listen to somebody tell me, "Well, God," you know, I don't think God gives a shit. Mm-hmm. I just don't think if God exists, obviously he doesn't give a shit because the shit exists. Maybe God's gay. And that will freak out a lot of.
And it's the mental and emotional gymnastics. They could get gold medals with the mental and emotional gymnastics and rationalization. You know, these are you know, we're talking about men who do everything under the sun with other men, but don't think they're gay because they've got a girlfriend or a wife.
On this, yeah, or you know, they've got a beard.
Or yeah, or whatever, or a beard, whatever you want to call it. But they don't think, you know. And I've always had this joke where, you know, like hooking up with another dude, even if you're doing it during like halftime at the Super Bowl, it's the gayest thing that you can do.
Halftime at the Super Bowl,
right? Like, listen. Sporting a wig and some heels on a parade float on a Sunday in June is some pretty gay shit. All right. You know, camping out for a week for front row tickets to Liza's revival tour. That's some gay shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there is nothing gayer than two really butch Budweiser drinking dudes hooking up. That's the gayest thing two guys can do. By definition. Do. Yes.
All that's the time. That's
as gay as it gets. Period. I don't care if you're wearing shoulder pads doing it.
Especially if you're wearing shoulder pads. It's seriously the pads that you got to worry about. Say the secret word, win $100.
But don't kiss me because I ain't gay.
That was all my right. Evil twin Skippy.
But do everything else.
Do it all. Just don't do it here. Wait a minute, let me get out my camera, then you can do it here.
Yeah, but I don't kiss on the mouth.
That's on the first date.
Yeah, because that's gay, but do everything else.
That's
okay. All right, Sparky.
Don't get me started, man. We could do this for an hour.
Yes, we could.
I worked in a newsroom one time where a guy was self-loathing as you will ever see in your life and denying. I mean, everyone knew he was out but him.
Mm-hmm.
And he hated gay people. And I was like, but I'm sorry, Judy Garland, you dressed up as Judy Garland.
Yeah.
Halloween.
That's therapy shit. That's therapy shit. That's like, that's way above my pay grade. Like
your boyfriend came as the Cowardly Lion.
Oh God.
I don't know what to say to this. Mm-hmm, I don't know what to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. Oh, well. Well, George is a lot of fun.
Oh, this is the gayest thing I've done, Brian, in weeks. Thank you so much.
Well, glad to help. Karam's therapy sessions are free. Come on down.
I feel so refreshed.
It's twoo.
I feel so refreshed.
Yeah. Anyway, you got to come back. We'll talk.
I would love it. This is a blast. I love talking to you.
Yeah, you too, man. It was a lot of fun.
All right.
So the name of the show is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with George Hahn. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth. With Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.